Amid everything else happening in the world of politics right now, the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations held an open hearing today. The topic, authority to order the use of nuclear weapons, or more bluntly, the president's unilateral authority to launch a nuclear attack. Republican Senator Bob Corker, head of that committee, has said it's time for Congress to review the realities of the president's authority to order a nuclear attack, something Congress hasn't done in about four decades.
While Corker didn't call out the current president by name, it's no secret that he's been openly and publicly feuding with the president, at one point calling the White House, quote, adult daycare. But regardless of who's in office, there are questions to be considered about who should have a say in launching a nuclear weapon and whether or not it's appropriate or safe to have that decision fall on just one person.
Jeremy Suri joins us now. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. His most recent book is The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Rob, thanks for having me on.
Jeremy, is it that simple? The president, whoever the president is, pretty much has unilateral authority to launch a nuclear attack if he or she sees fit?
Well, it's actually pretty complicated, Rob, because our entire nuclear structure is designed to respond to an attack upon the United States. It was not created for a first strike by the United States. So the system is set up to monitor someone attacking us and then give the president a call and ask the president if he wishes to respond. Now, the president could use a provocation such as the downing of an American aircraft or a missile fired by the North Koreans and call that a provocation. But then the head of strategic command, who he would contact directly or indirectly, and has to make a decision as to whether that is a legal order or not. And remember, military officers are sworn to defend the Constitution of the United States. They are not sworn loyalty to the president of the United States.
But in general, the system is designed for the president, as you say, to be able to make a quick decision in the event of a Soviet attack, is what this was designed for back in the day, basically. Is the military really going to refuse that order when it comes?
We don't know. It's never happened. I do think there would be questions raised if this seemed to come out of the blue. But I think the realistic scenario is where an American bomber is shot down near North Korea, or a North Korean missile lands in Japan or lands in Guam. And then the president uses that as a provocation to justify a nuclear strike. Then I think it's likely that the system would respond with the launch of nuclear missiles on North Korea.
We're in kind of different territory than we were during the Cold War, because all the thinking then, I think, was, well, in the event of all-out nuclear attack by one side or another, how do you make sure that we do everything we can? Now it sounds like we're talking about the use of nuclear weapons in a much more limited way in the event of, as you say, a North Korean attack of some sort.
Right. There are three things that I think have changed, Rob. One is the point you made very well, that the nature of the adversary is different and the nature of what conflict would look like. This would not be all-out full-scale thermonuclear war we're talking about. This would be a more limited set of strikes. But there are two other things that have changed. One is, of course, the nature of the president himself. Senator Corker is holding these hearings because there's concern about the stability of the president of the United States, and we have the first president ever to be callously and somewhat thoughtlessly brandishing nuclear threats, talking about bringing fire and untold destruction on other societies. That certainly has changed the calculation and concerns for people like Senator Corker. And then another thing that has changed, of course, is that we live in a world now with more nuclear powers. And this is not a bilateral crisis, U.S.-Soviet Union. This involves China. This involves Russia. This involves South Korea. So there are many, many other players involved, and our system is not designed for that either.
Talking to Jeremy Suri about the president's authority when it comes to nuclear weapons. A Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing looks at that today. And Jeremy, let's get into that now. Senator Corker, you just mentioned him, said it's time to review the realities of the president's authority. Is this a good time, regardless maybe of even who the president is now, to rethink how a nuclear launch works?
I think, Rob, this is a good time to think about authority over warfare in general. The Constitution of the United States is quite clear that any war action requires a declaration of war by Congress. But since World War II, the last time we declared war formally through Congress, Congress has ceded authority to the president because of the concerns about rapid crises that the president would have to respond to during the Cold War. We're no longer in a Cold War world, and we don't face the same kinds of immediate crises that threaten the survival of the United States. And so it seems to me it's an appropriate time, as I think Senator Corker has argued and many others have argued, for Congress to reassert its role, not simply over nuclear weapons, but over the deployment of troops, over the way we use our military force around the world. Congress has ceded too much authority. I think it's time for Congress to talk about playing its real constitutional role here.
There was this congressional authorization of the use of force. I think that the technical name was something like that back after 9/11. Presidents, multiple presidents, have got a lot of mileage out of that, using it in ways I think not initially intended. Is that one example of where Congress maybe didn't exercise enough authority?
Yes, and I think the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has made that point today, and I believe Senator Corker made that point last week, which is that we might need to rethink that resolution. It's quite similar to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution that I'm sure many of your listeners remember or know about from 1964 that Lyndon Johnson used from the summer of 64 to justify the entire war in Vietnam. We have a similar situation here where a congressional resolution that was designed to respond to a particular threat at a particular moment has been stretched by Democratic and Republican presidents. And that seems to be constitutionally questionable, and I don't think it's also wise in terms of policymaking.
Looking again at the nuclear authority in particular, there's one civilian in the process, it sounds like the president, also acting as the commander-in-chief, then it goes into military hands. Is there a suggestion that more civilians, whether that's a Secretary of Defense or some sort of congressional oversight, should go into the process before the use of nuclear weapons?
I think that should be mandated in the process. Right now, the presumption is that the head of strategic command would, in all probability, especially if he's uncertain about the order, call the Secretary of Defense. Well, what makes that complicated is, of course, our Secretary of Defense now, Jim Mattis, is a military man himself. I mean, he's out of uniform, but he's not a civilian in the way in which traditional military secretaries of defense have been. So there's concern about that, and this has been a longstanding concern, Rob. In 1974, Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger, during Watergate, when he was concerned that Nixon was a little unsteady, requested that all military authorities come to him if there's a request from the president for the use of force. That was unconstitutional, or at least extra-constitutional, but that might be something we might want to work into the process as a required element.
As I understand it, many stages in a nuclear launch are very, very highly classified, to where people who have started the process of thinking about how we do this have been locked out of reading their own reports. Members of Congress have a very hard time accessing this kind of information. Does it make it hard for Congress to talk about something when a lot of this is opaque?
Yes, it's doubly hard because so much of it is secret, and there are some reasons why it's good that it's secret. I mean, we don't want the Russians to know where to hack into the system. So some of the problem is secrecy. And quite frankly, Rob, the biggest problem is that we've never used these procedures. So we don't actually know what would happen. What we do know is that the president of the United States would either be called because of an action overseas that seems to threaten the U.S., or he would initiate a call to the head of strategic command, who is a military officer. And the head of strategic command would then have to decide whether that is a legitimate order or not. And if he believes it is, that would trigger the beginnings of a nuclear launch. But he would have a lot of discretion as to whether to call the Secretary of Defense or not. Some have questioned whether he himself could ask to invoke the 25th Amendment. There's a lot of authority in the hands of military officers, and we don't know what they would do because we've never run this before. We've never actually been in this situation. So that's what makes this, I think, particularly scary.
We're talking about a president's power to launch nuclear strikes. It's an issue discussed this morning in front of the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee, and whether or not changes might be needed. Jeremy Suri is with us, professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin.
And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. Should the president have sole authority over firing a nuclear weapon? Does it matter who occupies the office? What alternatives could or should be considered? And what questions questions do you have? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're continuing our conversation about a president's power to launch a nuclear strike. That's an issue the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee took up this morning. Our guest is Jeremy Suri. He's professor of history and public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. And he's the author of The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the president have more or less unchecked powers over the nation's nuclear weapons? Is it time to review, to maybe change things? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page to your calls now. Peter is with us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. I want to say that I think that by not saying that he wouldn't be the first to use a nuclear weapon is actually putting us at a higher risk of there being a nuclear war by North Korea miscalculating what we're doing and thinking we're starting a nuclear war and starting a nuclear war. And the other thing I want to talk about quickly that your guest touched on is, as far as our policy in Afghanistan, Barack Obama said he was going to pull us out of Afghanistan. He never actually did. Trump said the same thing, and then he's still went with the generals and continued the war in Afghanistan. So I hope the next president actually has the courage to pull us out of there and doesn't listen to the military.
Peter, thanks for the call. So the idea of the U.S. Committing or not to not using nuclear weapons as a first strike, Jeremy.
This is a great point that Peter makes, and many scholars, myself included, have argued for the last decade that the United States should make a no-first-use pledge globally, that we would never use nuclear weapons first. There's no reason for us to use nuclear weapons first. We have such overwhelming conventional advantage. Why would we ever want to use nuclear weapons first? And by, as Peter said, by threatening or at least implying that we might use them first, that justifies other countries having nuclear weapons. It also creates the possibility where other countries might perceive, when we have a president as we do now who makes unbridled threats, they might perceive that we are about to launch our nuclear weapons, and they might launch first. That's the concern here, that Kim Jong-un in North Korea might believe that we're about to start a nuclear war and that he would want to use his weapons before we launch against his. We should have a no-first-use pledge globally that we would never use our weapons before anyone else in a nuclear context.
Peter, thanks for that call. Go next to Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Here's a scenario. How much does Putin trust Donald Trump? Donald Trump, if Donald Trump is going to send a ICBM to North Korea, but first tells Vladimir Putin, hey, this missile is headed toward North Korea, does Putin really think it's headed toward North Korea, or maybe it's really headed toward Russia?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Jeremy, confusion arising when a nuclear weapon is launched. He's giving the example of a missile in this case.
Yeah, so, I mean, the concerns about misperception are pretty serious, and there's a lot of very good work that's been done by scholars and by military officials on this. For example, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the United States launched a test missile from California from Vandenberg Air Base, and he also had a U-2 aircraft that crossed into Soviet airspace by accident. We're lucky that those two incidents were not perceived by the Soviets as a nuclear launch by the United States. We also had a case in 1979 when Zbigniew Brzezinski, the NSC advisor, was called and told the Soviets had launched a nuclear strike. It turns out that there had been a test tape in the Strategic Air Command system, and they thought the test tape was the reality. That's why these weapons are so dangerous. The best thing we could do is be to lower the tensions around nuclear weapons and pledge not to use them first, as we just talked about, to make it less likely that there are misperceptions. The strongest argument for disarmament is the argument that the caller just made, which is a concern about these weapons being misused and misperceived in their use, creating a much larger war.
Thanks for that call. I've seen the case made, Jeremy, that of the three pieces of our nuclear puzzle, nuclear subs, bombers, and ICBM missiles, we should get rid of the missiles, because once you launch them, there's no way to take them back. You can call a bomber back, you can call a submarine back. Is that something that anybody's thinking about?
Yeah, this is an argument that's been made by many. Part of the Global Zero initiative that President Obama pushed during his first term involved just this. The problem is that many other countries, like Russia, find missiles easier to
field and less expensive to manufacture than submarines. But the most secure nuclear deterrent weapons are submarines because they're almost impossible to track. And they therefore provide you an almost guaranteed retaliatory capability. So I think fewer missiles and, quite frankly, fewer bombers would be very wise. And we've been fortunate that since the end of the Cold War, we've been able to reduce the number of missiles we deploy. In my own city of Austin, there used to be nuclear bombers and nuclear missiles. Thankfully, they're not there anymore. There were many in Wisconsin. I'm fearful we're entering back into a world where we're going to see more nuclear missiles deployed, and that's going to make us all less safe.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Jeremy, I mean, people who lived through the 60s had the fear of nuclear war back in the 70s and 80s, too. It's been off our radar. Have we been naive all along, or is this a new scary period for us?
I think it's different from our past. We study the past because we want to study the past to understand how the present is different. And we don't really face a threat today as we did in 1983 or in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis of the United States and the Soviet Union destroying the entire planet. That's not going to happen. But we face perhaps a higher probability risk now of limited use of nuclear weapons, which would cause millions of lives to be lost. The estimates I've seen by people who have studied this closely is that even a small-scale conventional and then small-scale nuclear interchange between the United States and North Korea would result in more than a million deaths in South Korea and North Korea and the region. That's the kind of risk and danger that we face today. And that's harder to control because it involves more players. So that's all the more reason why we need to focus on these issues, not just the horrible prospect of nuclear war, but the reality of the need to control, reduce these weapons, and be very careful in the kinds of threats we make. We've become a rogue nuclear state in the last year, and that's undermining our own security.
Jeremy, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Jeremy Suri is the Mac Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership and Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. His most recent book is The Impossible Presidency, The Rise and Fall of America's Highest Office. He joined us to talk about the president's unilateral power to launch a nuclear strike and why some are calling that power into question.
Interpreters are crucial to the state's court system, but finding an interpreter that speaks a rare language is a challenge. As Mary Lee Williams reports, a lack of interpreters can have serious consequences.
Could you please tell the court and the jury what you did?
It's the last day of a two-day training for people who want to become certified court interpreters, and the classroom is full. The Hmong and Arabic speakers are practicing simultaneous interpreting, which is interpreting while being spoken to. Vab Aaron Zhang, a medical and civil interpreter, says she wants to get certified in Hmong. Her experience going through the court system as a kid influenced her decision to get certified.
Just because you can speak a language or two languages doesn't mean that you are qualified to interpret, period, let alone be a certified interpreter and know what all of the legal jargon was and all of the vocabulary and terms.
Wisconsin is in need of more certified court interpreters who speak rare languages, which is basically any language other than Spanish. Of the top five most frequently used languages last year, Hmong, Arabic, and Burmese don't have any fully certified interpreters living in the state of Wisconsin. Certified interpreters have to pass two tests, among other requirements. The oral test has a low pass rate. The state doesn't even offer a certification test for all languages, like Burmese. Carmel Kapati directs the court interpreter program in Wisconsin. She says the state needs more certified interpreters who speak rare languages. Kapati says unqualified people do come into court.
It's not just a challenge for our state, it's a challenge for all those other states that have, you know, immigrant and refugee populations of individuals who speak rare languages where they get to have their day in court too.
If one or sometimes two court interpreters can't be found in time for a trial, it can be put off, delaying justice. And if a judge notices a court interpreter isn't fulfilling their duties, they can stop everything and start over. Retired Dane County Circuit Court Judge Bill Faust worked with many interpreters during his career. He says a scheduling hearing doesn't necessarily need a certified interpreter, but contested trials are different.
You're risking having your whole court proceeding be overturned if it can later be proven that the interpreter was bad.
Enrique Soria is a certified Spanish interpreter. He says having a bad interpreter is like having a bad attorney. Soria says he once worked with somebody who misinterpreted a crucial answer to a question during a parental rights case. He says in that case, it could have changed the outcome. Interpreters work in teams during trials to make sure they catch mistakes like this, because court interpreting requires more than simply being bilingual. Still, Soria says mistakes happen.
That's why interpreters need to be trained and need to do study and need to have an extensive practice and observation so they can do this job well and do it correctly, because people's lives and careers and relationships are all at stake.
Carmel Capati, who manages the court interpreter program, says her office is working with different departments like refugee services to try and recruit more people who speak rare languages. But it's hard when the tests are expensive, challenging, and the work is sometimes infrequent. Mary Lee Williams, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics. We'll catch up on the latest news from Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore and other big stories out of Washington.
We'll find out about efforts to preserve Wisconsin's folk culture, from traditional crafts to traditional songs.
And if you're caring for an aging relative, we've got some help for you. We'll talk to the author of the new book, A Caregiver's Guide to Living Your Best Life.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 8, from mousy cats to sheepish coyotes, a wildlife expert looks at the science of animal personalities. That's tomorrow morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll look at Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony before the House Judiciary Committee today and what it means for the Russia investigation. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.